Welcome to Think Digital Futures. I'm Dan Butler. We talk a lot about exciting and scary new technologies on this show and what they mean for our everyday lives. Well, today we're going to zoom out a little bit and talk about the moment we find ourselves in, this era of incredible change. We can call it the fourth industrial revolution. The first was sparked by the loom machines that revolutionized the manufacturing industry and led to steam power. The second involved electricity, air travel, and more. And the third was the digital revolution that began last century. And now, in the fourth industrial revolution, we bear witness to the truly awesome power of artificial intelligence, blockchain technologies, and increasingly sophisticated robotics. Just like the preceding revolutions, it isn't just the technological advances themselves, but the all-pervasive social changes that they engender. Nicholas Davis is an adjunct professor at Swinburne University of Technology, a visiting professor at University College London, and together with Klaus Schwab, the executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, wrote a book detailing the opportunities and challenges our revolution poses. He and I spoke earlier.
You refer in the book or advise against viewing technology as mere tools. What's the danger of approaching them in this way?
The danger is that if you think of something as a tool without any kind of ethics or morality or power over you, you think it's something that we can easily pick up and put down whenever we want, something to discard perhaps, or and you say, okay, look, I'm the user, I'm the human here, I'm the subject, and this object is something that essentially is there to serve me. And I think if we take that view with technology and with the built environment, we'd be making a mistake, because the evidence is that humans are technological beings, we're tool users, but those tools, the very existence of those tools, have a huge amount of power in shaping us. There's the old adage that, to the person with the hammer, everything looks like a nail. That's a little bit of a quip that points to the fact that if you have a tool, you're more likely to use it. It's why we don't have guns lying around in Australian society, because guns as tools invite a certain type of action. But there's also a little bit more of an insidious action of the way that tools and infrastructure can have power over us, and that is they can be designed either explicitly or perhaps sometimes recklessly to exclude people or to affect their human rights. And one of the classic examples of this, at least in the literature on technology, is the way that New York, the city of New York, was designed. When it was master planned in the early parts of the 20th century, the decision was made to actually create quite low overpasses across major highways that were leading out of the city towards the beaches on the eastern side of the city over on Long Island. And those overpasses were deliberately put at a low enough level that buses couldn't pass under them. And the argument goes that part of the reason behind that was because low-income communities in New York heavily relied on the bus system. They didn't have cars themselves in that period. Cars were very expensive back in the early part of the 20th century. And so relying on public transport meant if the public transport couldn't get to the beach, those beaches would be essentially reserved for more privileged populations. There's good evidence that was a very deliberate choice by the designers of the city. An example of a breakthrough, the highway system and the road system, very much a breakthrough technology and infrastructure technology at the time of the second industrial revolution, because the car had only recently come into existence as we know it with the internal combustion engine. And yet the design of that infrastructure, the highway wasn't a tool, or if it, at least it wasn't a tool that everyone had power over. It was something that stayed there, and those overpasses still exist, many of them, and really shaped the social fabric and the set of opportunities that people had. So as we think about technologies today, it's good for us to step back and say, Facebook or any kind of sharing platform, it's not just something that I can choose to use or not. It has a whole set of power in terms of how it's designed. And in many cases, I can't afford not to use it. because maybe my employer wants me to engage in that platform in a certain way.
How then do we embed values into technology? It's a very broad question, but I suppose it begins in the very statement that technology isn't without value.
Yeah, I think it does. So first of all, recognizing that we do always embed our values in technology. We, you know, the modern example of this is any machine learning system is learning from something. You get a problem normally in supervised learning. You have a particular challenge that you want to train the computer to solve. One of the classic examples is distinguishing cats from dogs on the internet, and we've got a lot of data on cats and dogs on the internet. So you put in a picture and you select a number of images labeled cats, and you train the data on that. You test it on a large number, and hopefully you get, as you are today, well over 99.5% accuracy on determining if that's a cat or not. But the quality of data you train that on will determine the accuracy of the system on new images in being able to determine that. And so the system can be very biased by what you put in, by the design of the algorithm itself, by the context in which you use it. And we've seen, I'm sure you and your listeners are very aware, we've seen some cases where by training machine learning algorithms on limited privileged populations, their accuracy rate with marginalized communities and less represented populations is awful, which in the case of making decisions in social justice is a travesty and a human rights issue of huge proportions. So that element of understanding that bias is actually a question of, you know, of the values of the system is and the values of the decisions to use that system is important. It's going on beyond just saying this is a faulty tool, and it's more saying, gosh, actually, our values, the way in which the data that we have around us, the choices that we make, are being actually locked into and built into, say, a sentencing tool or even a soap dispenser in the bathroom at the other end that doesn't work on people with darker hued skin. We're building in our ethics, our values inadvertently or perhaps deliberately sometimes in those systems, and being able to understand that making sure those systems work effectively across a wide range of populations is incredibly important. So first step, recognizing it. Second step, trying to adjust for it. And third step, if you do see it happening, we got to really rethink the design and use of those technologies.
I suppose it leads into the obvious danger about technologies is that they have the opportunity to level some inequalities but entrench others. That's the case, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so. And I think that what we should do in taking a kind of a bit more of a historical perspective on this is to understand that's always been the case. We have very luckily over the last few industrial revolutions dramatically increased average and median incomes overall, and people on the whole across the planet are living longer. There's far fewer people living in absolute poverty than there ever were in history. Technology has driven that growth, combined with innovations in markets, in much more elements of positive cooperation, and both peace and economic activity have gone hand in hand over that period. The world is now kind of safer, and fewer people are dying in conflict than they ever have as well. So we can't just ignore the fact that technology has overall led to great things. But throughout those periods, we've also created massive externalities, excluded people, and actually directly hurt people. And we continue to do so. If you look at the externalities that come from the road system and the automobile, you know, we still have millions of deaths around the world a year, in very traumatic circumstances from road deaths, from road crashes. And that's something that technology could help to solve. But at the same time, we have to be really careful to design, for instance, autonomous vehicle policy and autonomous vehicle systems to make sure that it's not just wealthy people that get to enjoy that service, to make sure that the congestion of the potential congestion that results from lots of cars driving around with no one in them doesn't unfairly fall on poorer communities, and that as much as possible, the opportunities of new technologies are being offered to as many Australians as possible, and the benefits are really being shared. And that includes in things like taxation as well, Daniel. Like there are lots of elements here in new technologies where our policies, our regulations, need to be looked at and carefully designed, and to be done so for the long-term sustainability of the country as well as everyone's benefit.
Just on that matter of taxation, going into the fourth industrial revolution, that is going to revolutionize industry, of course, and we may see or almost certainly will see the automation of a large swathe of jobs. What do you think about the prospect of, say, monetizing data or taxing data?
There's a really difficult set of questions here. Traditionally, taxation systems operate on a couple of principles. The first one is the tax that you can practically collect is a lot more important than the tax that you could theoretically charge. So we want to make sure that in tax systems that the government is and people are focused on the practicalities of being able to be fair in terms of design, be practical in terms of collection, and then on the back of that, be very effective in terms of redistribution and spending of those tax receipts in different ways. So, when you say things like taxing data, we have to, or even taxing robots, it's the first step is saying, well, what do we actually mean by that? Because if we mean we're taxing high technology capital or capital that has a high tech component in it, immediately you get the reaction of, well, hold on a second, we want to make sure that Australians as a whole are more productive, that Australian businesses and businesses operating in Australia are as productive as possible, because we know that over history it's higher productivity that creates jobs, etc. So if we start to put a barrier in ways of things that raise productivity, we actually could be shooting ourselves in the foot and end up with an ineffective tax regime. Of course, on the other hand, if you try and say, well, we should be taxing consumption, that means that the people that have a highest share of consumption in their daily lives as a proportion of their income, which is the poorest people in Australia and around the world, they will be hardest hit by the tax. So I think finding ways to make sure that we're taxing kind of either revenue or profits at the appropriate moment, and we're able to accurately assess that and that not be hidden or uncertain in any way, is an important first start to this discussion. And of course, Australia has been looking very closely at this issue. Treasury has been looking in particular at new ways to tax digital platforms, the largest digital platforms in particular, and the OECD as well has a major project on this topic that's ongoing. And I think the solution has to be one where lots of countries come together, because in a globalized world, it would be tricky for Australia to unilaterally do something that diverged greatly from the rest of the world, if that meant that Australian consumers and businesses lost out on the technology investments that would otherwise come.
What do you think about the future of work? It's a very broad question, but and also the impact there for the education system? What is it that we should be teaching people that they can actually use for their professions going into the future?
I think broadly the future of work is one where the tasks we do day to day are going to change slightly faster than they have been. Alpha Beta Advisors in Sydney did a great report with FYA, Future Youth Australia, and Foundation for Youth Australia, I think it is, and a few others that that pointed out over the last 10 or 12 years in Australia, changes in technology have shifted Australians' work patterns and work processes quite a significant amount. The average Australians, or a million Australian perhaps, has gained about 2 hours a week of more highly paid, higher value work in customer and client interactions, in more interpersonal work, and has done 2 hours a week less of routine administrative and kind of manual work. So that's a good thing. It's correlated with higher wages and with higher job satisfaction. The danger comes if it's not just a small percentage of tasks that change, or perhaps up to a third of tasks that we expect to change in most jobs over the next 5 years. But if that starts to kind of cascade into entire job categories being destroyed, and perhaps with multiple categories kind of disappearing all at once, then you do get this shock whereby people currently trained and expert in those positions, or relying on those positions and well trained in those positions, have to transition into other jobs and other sectors relatively rapidly. And the ability for our education system to cope with that at the moment is fairly low. World Economic Forum research on that topic shows that if you have a good affinity across a job category, and so you want to move from a position in the transport industry, which now starts to become more and more automated, and you want to move to a similar but different position in logistics, in many cases that shift to stay at the same level of wages and job conditions, you require about 2 years of experience and 2 years of additional training. And that's a really huge cost. If you multiply that across the workforce, that's really difficult. So I think we really need to be anticipating as much as possible where those transitions are occurring, and putting our education efforts directly at those transitions now to ensure that people are looked after, and that the economy doesn't suffer a shock in terms of an oversupply of less skilled people, and of course the loss of both consumption and production that would imply. I do also think that we want universities like UTS and others to be working on a broader set of skills, technical skills, basic technical skills, innovation skills, collaboration skills, and cognitive skills that are very adaptable to multiple different jobs and areas where people will be working with technology.
A lot of us tend to define ourselves through our work, and given the incredible changes that are not only going to happen there, but in so many aspects of life because of the change that's coming, do you ever deal with the sort of more philosophical question of what it means to be human going forward into this new age?
Yeah, I think it's the question of what it means to be human can be taken in a couple of different ways. I don't think we're morphing into aliens or kind of terminators in the short term, and despite, you know, things like Neuralink, Elon Musk's startup, etc., we're not that close yet to being able to upload our consciousness into computers. We are starting to be able to draw images of dreams and thoughts, however, which is very interesting, and the whole new neurotechnology space is one of the most fascinating and scary that I spend time looking at. But I think the question of what it means to be human is much more a realization that we are beings that rely heavily on technology. And, you know, if an archaeologist or anthropologist wants to look for evidence of humans, they will look for evidence of tools, because we are tool users. That's what distinguishes us from other animals. And the tools that we use, as we've already talked about, Daniel, really define the type of society and structure that we work in and heavily influence our relationships with people. You can just look at the influence of social media on the way we engage with one another in public debate, on voting patterns and the influence on politics and political discourse, or the ability that mobile phones plus GPS plus internet access and applications have had on dating life and relationship formation. It's been incredible in just all those changes have happened in the last 10 years, really. So I think the question of what it means to be human is not so much are we changing ourselves into something we don't recognize, but more to say, what are those aspects of ourselves as human beings that we really want technology to magnify? And we probably don't want, you know, violent and aggressive and discriminatory tendencies whereby humans have traditionally created in-group and out-group dynamics and pointed the finger and blamed others people's for kind of mistakes, etc. Those are probably not the human emotional tendencies that we want our technology to magnify. And yet there's a very strong case to be made that algorithms today that serve us information are training us to have more extreme views and to click on things that more and more accord with our prejudices and biases. So fighting those kind of aspects and really attending to things like the International Declaration on Human Rights as part of what we mean to be human, those rights that are embedded in international law and should be embedded in the technologies around us, I think those aspects of humanity are what we can turn to and do a check on our own behavior every day, like so being at the breakfast table with the kids with a tablet or phone and a check on that behavior and what it means to be human in a family context, but also in the policies we make or the products we design.